I once stood atop a massive sand dune south of the Atlas Mountains in Morocco, looking across a vast and empty desert. Standing there, I marveled at how remote we were, and my guide said, "Yes, the next stop is Timbuktu," literally. I skied down that dune on my heels, and we returned to our jeep and headed back to the village I was calling home. That's as close as I ever got to Timbuktu. But about 20 years ago, Rick Antonsen actually trekked there across the desert with his Malian guide, Zach. He wrote a book about his experience, and the book is called To Timbuktu for a Haircut. And right now, Rick Antonsen joins us to reminisce. Rick, thanks for being with us.
Oh, nice to be a part of a conversation with you always.
So this is something. If you look at the map of Africa, there's a landlocked country called Mali. And if somebody lives there, it's called a Malian?
Yes.
Malian, okay. And you had this guide, Zach, and you were trekking to the mysterious city of Timbuktu. I love how you write about sleeping on rooftops of mud houses under those vast African skies. Tell us, just to set the table here, what was this trek? How far was it? How long did it take? Tell us what you did.
So getting to Timbuktu was something that, as a kid, we would always say, "Daddy, Daddy, where are you going?" I'm 5 years old. I'm 6 years old. "Daddy, Daddy, where are you going?" He would always say, whether he was going to church or to work, or he would say, "I'm going to Timbuktu to get my hair cut." That's what he would say. So as an older, traveler, I wanted to go to Timbuktu to get my hair cut. That was the motivation. Simple as it sounds, off I was going. Zach became my guide. And now, two decades later, we're still in touch once every couple of months. He's had to move around a lot because of the danger of being in Mali. You and I wouldn't go to Timbuktu today. We would be kidnapped bait. It would be very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But then, while it was awkward and had some dangers, it was a fascinating place to travel to. In the desert, it used to be known as the most remote place on Earth. It was mysterious. It was thought of to be having streets paved with gold. Gold would come from the south in Africa to trade with salt from the north, from the Sahara, and they would trade a pound for a pound. A pound of gold for a pound of salt.
Holy cow, isn't that something?
Ounce for ounce, weight for weight.
It's hard for us to imagine, before Europeans named Africa the Dark Continent, that it was a thriving continent that rivaled and even surpassed Europe in a lot of cultural things. And Timbuktu was sort of a legendary city, a trading center that in trade was on par with London or even Venice. And today, there's very little left of that. And I'm just curious, what it was like for you on your trek to approach Timbuktu, that fabled town, and finally enter it after so many memories of your dad saying, "I'm going to Timbuktu to get a haircut. You're coming into town." What was that like?
I think fighting my own expectations. Part of me wanted it to look like what I imagined in the 1400s. Part of me wanted to see some insights of, gosh, this was such a celebratory place, when in fact it evokes poverty and needs.
And you even wrote, "Timbuktu does not long to be loved. It shrugged at my arrival."
It was indifferent.
That was a great line. That was a great, "Here I am. Where's my haircut?"
Exactly.
No fanfare. It was just a dusty town. 50,000 people still, I understand.
It's now closer to 10,000.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 10,000 to 15,000.
Well, that must be the result of desertification. I mean, talk about a sad story now, especially considering its amazing heritage. Crippled by poverty, ravaged by terrorists and civil strife, and with this rising tide of sand, under 100-degree heat every day.
Well, and trees that used to be nearby, or foliage that grew up around the river, a lot of that has been taken for firewood or taken for other uses. So there's nothing to hold the earth in place. So it moves with the wind, and the wind is bringing sand. So that is very difficult. It's difficult breathing. Because this used to be French West Africa, they've got sort of the culinary legacies. The bread in Timbuktu is fantastic. And there are ovens on the streets where they're making wonderful bread. But as you eat this gorgeous tasting bread, you're very conscious that you're also chewing on sand.
Now, sadly, the situation for visitors, for tourism, is zero, because the United States has said it's not safe to go there. I doubt if there's any tourism there right now. It's just too dangerous if you're kidnappable or if you're not a jihadist. Do you think much about that when you think back about your visit? I mean, it must be sort of heartbreaking to consider. You know, what happened to the town? What happened to Zach?
And Zach will still do some guiding. He's done different things to try and make his living. But you're right, the jihadists have come in. They were the ones that tried to destroy the town and tear down some of the mosques and do devastation. So Zach, who doesn't live in Timbuktu but nearby, has had to move to other parts of Mali. Right. He actually had to leave the country for a while with his young family to find employment.
Wow. This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we're joined by Rick Antonsen. And he's written Route 66 Still Kicks after taking the ultimate American road trip. He's written The Train Beyond the Mountains after journeying across Canada on that wonderful train there. And he's written a book about his adventures in Timbuktu. It's called To Timbuktu for a Haircut. To learn more about Rick's writing and his work, you can go to his website. It is rickantonson.com, A-N-T-O-N-S-O-N. Now, Rick, I understand the reason for your visit, along with finding that haircut that your dad always talked about, was your fascination with historic manuscripts. And Timbuktu, by some amazing circumstance, has all of these riches in manuscripts, centuries-old manuscripts, in a landlocked place that's suffering from a rising tide of sand. What's the reason that Timbuktu has all of these manuscripts, and why are they so important to you?
Timbuktu was a center of trade. Even though Europeans didn't know where it was, Africans did. And Africans would come from hundreds and hundreds of miles away to trade salt for gold. The other thing that they were said to trade in was ink. And the rationale behind that statement is that they had benevolent governance that created a number of madrasas, a number of universities. So they had at one point like about 23 universities. And if a camel caravan came in the 1400s or the 1300s or the 1500s, among what they carried would be manuscripts, early versions of a book. And they would detain it until they copied every manuscript or document.
So this was a requirement? If you came in, you had to let your manuscripts be copied?
And you wouldn't know that until you got there. But you would be detained until all of them were copied.
And they were hungry for this information before there was anything even hinting at Google.
Absolutely. And they would duplicate these. And so most of them would be in Arabic, some were in Hebrew, but they would keep these. And now here we are hundreds of years later where there are hundreds of thousands of ancient manuscripts in Timbuktu today.
This reminds me of Alexandria in Egypt.
Yes, about their library.
And every boat that docked in Alexandria, the great port at the mouth of the Nile, had to give up its books so they could be copied. They didn't take the books, they copied them. And then they put that book in the Library of Alexandria, which is the greatest library of the ancient world. And here in Timbuktu, we got the same thing going on.
Right, except for the challenge of the deterioration, because these are old, sand is getting at them, the periodic weather temperature changes, all of these. Plus, some of them are still in people's homes. They've been there for centuries. And these documents can be everything from what we would call a manuscript to perhaps a legal document, to perhaps one sheet of paper that was about a wedding ceremony with marginalia written down. But not everybody could read and write in those days, of course.
Right.
And it was said that those who could, as scholars, read and write, they were said to travel the ink roads.
The ink roads.
I love the term.
As you mentioned, ink was right there with salt and gold as a treasure to trade.
As a value, absolutely.
Information was power.
Well, and the insurgents tried to burn a number of the manuscripts 10 years ago because they wanted to get rid of that knowledge.
Yeah. Rick, it seems like a motive for you was to raise awareness of this and rally society to recognize that this is a cultural treasure that is at risk. What is the status of these beautiful manuscripts right now?
I'm in touch with Abdul Wahid, who runs a bibliothèque, Mohammed Tahar. And I've supported some of his endeavors to preserve manuscripts, to get them in proper boxes, to help people give them up from their homes so they can be preserved. During the time of the jihadists coming in, there was a big effort by some of the librarians to get the manuscripts, some of them, to better safety in Bamako, in the capital of Mali, which itself is an awkward place to travel
to. Does Mali
today.
Have a government that gets the importance of that?
Yes, and the United Nations, various efforts, some of the universities, a university from Norway, have been quite involved in trying to preserve these. They want to get them all, of course, digitalized. But even separating the pages can collapse the pages because they're that fragile. So it takes great effort. But there are stories, there's information, there's dialogue, there's data that if it doesn't get preserved, it will be lost to us forever because these are one-offs.
You know, Rick, you have learned so much in your travels and you've put so much energy into sharing it. I love the way you write. And from reading your book, it's clear that Mali has a special place in your heart. You wrote that, "In all my travels in Mali, I never found despair. Hardship, disappointment, poverty, indifference, and resignation were always evident, more so even than hope, but never despair." Talk about that for a sec.
I met a fellow who actually was a pilot in the Air Force, and we happened to be getting on a plane when I was leaving. And I talked a bit about this, and he said, you know, yes, people are poor, but they are happy. They are happy. They have subsistence economies. They trade for what they need. They are a really enjoyable people to be around. And they were who they are, and they welcomed you for who you are. And there was no angst. Where I traveled, they had food and friends and family. And in that way, no despair.
Rick Antonsen, your experiences remind me that when we get out and travel, out of our comfort zone, we realize this planet is filled with joy and love and beautiful people. You know, without romanticizing poverty, I think it's important for us here in the privileged first world with unthinkable wealth on a global scale to remember that half of humanity is trying to live on $5 a day and 10% of humanity is in extreme poverty, trying to live on $2 a day. And it sounds like Mali is in that zone of $5 a day, which, as you said, can be filled with joy. And of course, there's challenges. But if we could just overcome conflict, and if we can just have stability, and if we can just realize that this world is home to billions of joyful and loving people, and we can do that through travel, this world could be a better place. We could go to Timbuktu and enjoy a good haircut.
And I could recommend a barber.
Thanks for being with us, Rick. Best wishes in your travels.
Thank you.
Just a reminder that Mali is one of the rare countries to receive a level 4 do not travel warning from the U.S. State Department. Even its African neighbors have cautioned against traveling there due to the high level of violent crime and kidnapping of foreigners in the years since Rick Antonsen traveled there. While venturing around Wales, my colleague, Cameron Hewitt, came across one of its most delightful traditions one evening, listening to a community choir practice in a small town with a difficult-to-pronounce name.
On my first night in Wales, I had dinner at a cheap little Thai restaurant in Cardiff. Suddenly the lights went out and everyone around me started singing Happy Birthday, but in Welsh. Penblwydd hapus I ti. I'm Cameron Hewitt, and one of the things I really enjoy about traveling in Wales is hearing the Welsh language. It's the first tongue of many people in this corner of the UK, but travelers might not even realize how many people speak it. The Welsh people are such skilled code switchers, they automatically toggle to English for tourists. When I'm in Wales, I challenge myself to tackle Welsh pronunciations. For example, a double L sounds roughly like tla, and a double D is a hard the. Outsiders never quite master it, but the Welsh do appreciate when we try. Tonight, I want to be a fly on the wall of Welsh culture. That's why I'm heading to the little North Wales village of, I think it's pronounced Pwllglas? P-W-L-L-G-L-A-S. Pwllglas. The local community choir, the Côr Ruthun, is having its weekly Thursday night practice. I'm not sure I'll be able to find the Pwllglas Village Hall, but my B&B owner reassures me that it's only a one-street village. He says, just look for where all the cars are parked, and if you pop out at the far end of the village, you've gone too far. sure enough, you can't miss the village hall. It's the one with the full parking lot out front. As I step out of my car, I can already hear the choir warming up through the open windows. And once inside, they greet me warmly and tell me to pull up a chair. They're working on a brand new song, lots of starting and stopping. The director is wiry, salt-and-pepper-haired, and energetic. He plays the piano with gusto, coaxing a better and better performance out of his choir. I've had good choir directors, and I've had bad choir directors, and he's definitely a good one. And even trying out this song for the first time, they sound great. The lyrics are all in Welsh, and so is all of the instruction and all of the conversation between the songs. Not a word of English. It's a little mind-bending. I'm less than an hour's drive from England, but linguistically, I feel like I might as well be in Mongolia. When the director comes over to chat with me at the break, I'm kind of surprised that he speaks perfect English. He introduces himself with the proper Welsh name of Robert Arwin. He says they're always happy to have observers sitting on the rehearsals because having an audience makes them perform better. I ask why it's important for them to sing in Welsh, and immediately I realize this is a stupid question in Wales.
Well, for us, we're all Welsh language people, first language, and that's my first language, that's everybody's first language in the choir, so it makes sense that we sing in Welsh.
Okay.
There's lots more choirs in Wales that sing in English.
He rushes back to his piano for the next piece. It's Hail Holy Queen, that Latin Motown mashup from Sister Act. The Latin bits are still in Latin, but the normally English lyrics are in Welsh. Then they move into a more traditional Welsh song, this one with an even more exotic sound. Over the course of the 90-minute rehearsal, the sky outside fades from blue to pink to purple. And as I listen, I look out the windows at slate rooftops and bald mountains, and I realize that here I am experiencing something few other travelers get to. I'm not only enjoying a fine concert, I'm fully immersed in the culture of Wales.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. When you're on a road trip, you can listen to Travel with Rick Steves on one of more than 500 other radio stations. You'll find a list of where and when at ricksteves.com/radio. And we'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.